Hello and welcome to Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling. Dialect is Bristol's first podcast. Set up in 2002, it goes out every Friday afternoon at 2 p.m. on BCFM 93.2. This week, more about eco-villages and Ecoville 2000, one of the most ambitious projects ever. Unfortunately, though, it wasn't allowed to happen in Britain. To the planning regulators goes the blame. And miscarriages of justice are growing in Britain, in part due to the extinction of investigative TV documentaries such as the BBC's Rough Justice. But fear not, to the rescue comes Victims Unite website and editor Sabine McNeil, who we start with this week. Hi, Sabine, and welcome to Dialect.
Hello, Tony.
Now, this week you've been to prison, not you yourself behind being put behind bars, but visiting, I believe.
Well, I've been visiting now for, I think, about a year and a half. I've become quite an expert in what they call a joyous visiting experience, which is anything but joyous. It is absolutely horrendous. God only knows why I'm doing what I'm doing, but it needs to be done. It's terrible. It's absolutely
okay,
terrible.
Okay, so what have you seen this week and what have you found out? Because almost every time you do one of these prison visits, it's almost like you're putting a little bit more of the jigsaw together of what's wrong with our justice system.
Well, yes, it's very interesting. This time, Maurice Kirk came down to visit Melissa Laird in Holloway.
Now, he's the flying vet. We've had him on the show over the last 6 months several times.
Yes, and he came because Melissa once called him when she was on hunger strike because he had hunger strike experience. And he said to her, whatever happens, don't let them break your spirit. And that's why he wanted to meet her. And
so tell
him.
Us just a bit, Sabine, about the Melissa and her case.
Melissa was picked up in Spain in December 2011, was tricked into signing a document to extradite her son and was put into Holloway after 12 obnoxious, terrible days in a Spanish prison. And only today have a friend of mine with whom I've been visiting put the piece together. The social services responsible for this drama must have told the Spanish people that she abducted a child when in fact it was her own son. He was 4 at the time. She hasn't seen that little boy since December 11. She was found guilty of abducting a child. In fact, I just happened to have picked up this document only a couple of days ago when I put together this forensic chronology as part of a judicial review because she's supposed to be deported to America because she's American originally. It says a person in connection with a child. Well, she's the mother. A DNA test was even made. But we didn't realize that and why and how this kind of lie was invented in the first place, and the only reason was so that the social services could use a European arrest warrant to pick her up in Spain. And of course the Spanish culture would find it atrocious if a mother stole a child from somebody else. Therefore they beat her up, and therefore they didn't let her have the support of the US embassy. And of course she wouldn't have had an idea, she wouldn't have known what was going on, and we didn't understand it all. But the fact is, because she's an American, she's a bit more outspoken, a bit more daring, and she has found over 80 women who are also foreign nationals, who are also separated from their children, who are all in Holloway, held on what is called arbitrary hold by UKBA, i.e. the border agency. She's been held like this since June last year, and she was supposed to be deported on the 21st of July, 2 days before we managed to get a stay of deportation. And now I am anxious to see where that's going.
But I mean, surely it's actually better for her to be deported. At least then she has a chance of freedom. At the moment, she's stuck in limbo.
No, she has been told by lots of solicitors that once she's gone, she has no chance of ever seeing her son again.
Of course,
the legal proceedings would be, you know, just closed, gone for good.
So that's what this is about.
Yeah.
And tell us what about the hunger strike.
Well, that's been over and done with. At the time, the main effect was that two journalists were banned from seeing her in Holloway, and that they would have to sign a piece of paper saying that they would never write anything about whatever they see. And so there was not much publicity at all. I was never sent anything. One of my websites is called Publicity Online, and I published something about her and her hunger strike, and that caused somebody in Barnett Social Services to send a letter to her, but never to me. But it didn't... Well, she did get what she wanted at the time, which was an apology from the governor. But, Tony, what upset me so badly was that we got this stay of deportation on Friday morning, and I quite frankly, I didn't know what to expect and how to react, and I was in absolute shock, horror, and exhaustion, and only went very late to a big demo outside Downing Street, which had been staged to return our stolen children. This was called, if you like, the same kind of pattern, the same kind of issue, same kind of cause to demonstrate, and. I told her on Friday morning on the phone, and I visited her on the Tuesday afternoon. She was all blue and black and had one of her arms in a sling. And you will find on Victims Unite my post, she wins in court but gets beaten up in prison. Six staff assaulted her, and a senior officer was kind of watching. I got a letter from the head of custody in London, which denies anything and everything. I alerted Sir Bernard Hogan Howe, i.e. the chief boss of the Metropolitan Police, and he just said eventually, or his assistant, it's sort of difficult for the police to get into prison. Today, on the 13th, i.e. two and a half weeks later, a police officer from Islington was supposed to see her. Well, when she called me at 4 this afternoon, nobody had seen her yet. But that's not enough. In anticipation of her deportation, she packed all of her belongings, and we picked it up. First, we once went for nothing with the car. It wasn't available. The second time, we picked it all up. And when I then went through the box of her documents, all of her legal papers had been stolen.
Well, that's crazy, isn't it? It's actually surely illegal for them to do that in some way.
Well, it's about as illegal as assaulting a woman and leaving her stripped naked for 2.5 hours. She is in a wheelchair. She has arthritis in her knees. She has been operated in Whittington Hospital. I mean, it is so unbelievable.
Sounds incredible, Sabine. I mean, are you allowed, for example, when you go in to take photographs so people can see what kind of condition she's in?
No, I can't take anything in. I can't take photos. No.
Okay. Now, one of the other things that you've been posting on victims-unite.net is about mental capacity, I noticed. And this is one of the things that has fascinated me for years, this idea that you can actually be said to not have had the right mental capacity for committing a crime. It's almost as if, you could do something as horrendous as actually murdering somebody, but then a judge says, oh, well, actually the person doesn't have the right mental capacity, so they can't actually be tried for murder, or at least there will be mitigating circumstances. Now, this seems very, something where there's an enormous possibility for miscarriages of justice. But what's going on with this whole business of mental capacity, and what have you found out?
Ironically, it was John Hemming who has always been interested in the court of so-called protection and secret prisoners. And
this is your MP, isn't it? Your MP friend.
Well, he is the MP friend because he's the only one who stands up for all of these children who are being stolen and who tries to make a difference in that domain. And I hadn't looked into the secret prisoner issue until now. Len Lawrence made me aware of this super problem. But also at our last meeting, there was in particular one woman who has also been, who was declared to not to have mental capacity. I realized that and how it was used mainly to steal assets. So they use the secrecy of the family court to steal children, and they use the Protection and the Mental Capacity Act as a pretext for stealing the assets of especially elderly people. But then Lawrence discovered that whose house was taken and his savings disappeared, and 45,000, and he discovered that the Mental Capacity Act is also used for parents to be not to be declared able to consent to the adoption of their children. So an easy way of just adopting children against the will of the parents. Yeah. And Len, who was this pilot, who was he was basically poisoned, has got brain damage because of the in exhaust from aeroplanes. So he did have a valid brain injury as such, but it was abused, and he found out in the process that and how these certificates were not serialized, and therefore the information wasn't shared properly, and anybody and everybody could just abuse the Mental Capacity Act. Worse, he found that there are six judges who harmed him who were not on the list of approved 95 judges, approved for to act on behalf of the Court of Protection. So I put up a blog post, not on Victims Unite, but on Maurice's site, which I run in addition to his.
Well, that's fascinating. I mean, surely time for a judicial review of those cases then, if those judges were not supposed to be issuing those certificates for mental capacity.
Well, that's a very interesting point, because I've just discovered judicial reviews as the remedy, in quotes, as they call it, to hold public bodies into account, and I got really fascinated. And in fact, it was the third judicial review which gained the stay of deportation for Melissa, but it was put together by a barrister of public law, and he is very much behind not only her, but also all of the other foreign nationals. Now, that is then a judicial review against the Secretary of State, represented by the Treasury solicitor. I'm told that so in case of compensation needs to be paid. But what that does, that barrister says that the JR is abusive and totally without merit. So I'm very curious where that's going to take us.
You mentioned the Return Our Stolen Children demo, Sabine. Tell us about that.
Well, that has been initiated by a great guy called David Jenkins, who's been called a saint by more than one person since. He had four children taken in Cardiff, and he put this demo together mainly on Facebook. And as I say, I was so exhausted that I showed up only late on the day and didn't get all of the visuals, but they ended up staying for 8 days. And on the eighth day, on the Friday 26th, they handed in about 2,500 signatures to Downing Street. And I took photos of that and accompanied them. And
well, that's a bit frustrating. I mean, I haven't seen any coverage of that in the national press at all. I mean, there may have been. It may have passed me by. But this is something, the stealing of children, that you would have thought that the national press would take an interest in.
You would have thought, but, Christopher Booker in The Telegraph is the one and only regular writer. You can count on his column, and he can write that it is an international scandal. He can write it's a national scandal. It doesn't make a difference, Tony.
Well, it does make a difference in that at least more people are aware of it. One other aspect I'd like to talk to you about is the Pope, because I imagine, he has got some sort of spiritual interest in this, but what's he been saying?
Well, I read about this decree that he published, and I also read about that on a German site the other day, and I read that and how people were commenting about the fact that nobody seems to pick it up, and not of national mainstream media neither. But he said that public officials should act with more integrity and wouldn't have any immunity anymore. That's the big issue. But, I mean, in a way, it's sort of like international law says Nigel Cooper should have his daughter back. But who in the UK cares? They just don't respect it. So it's, you know, if paper law doesn't work or count or doesn't get respected, what matters is sort of brute force and the reality in 3D. You know, where is the child? Where is the gold? Where is the house, the key to the house? law doesn't seem to work anymore in a way.
Yeah, well, I mean, one of the things traditionally we think of is the church of being a kind of place of sanctuary, isn't it? In your experience, are any of the religions, you know, including, you know, all the sort of things like Buddhism, and I mean, you know, that's where people would go in medieval times, etc. You know, into the church to try and find a place of sanctuary. Say, for example, the authorities were trying to take their children away.
Yes, I certainly observe this kind of spiritual element amongst all of the victims, but I have yet to see any organization, because let's face it, religion is organized in the sense that people are also paid and there's money behind it. I have yet to see. There's one pastor who takes an interest in the Musas, and he did send somebody in his place to our last House of Commons meeting as well. But there is certainly no kind of, it's a strong engagement. I mean, we as volunteers are those who are in the front line, if you like, but not organized religion, not organized church.
Yeah, I know. I mean, I think maybe the fact of the matter is that it really depends on who the local vicar is, what kind of... I mean, for example, at the end of a Sunday service, if one of the people in the service turns to the vicar and says, "I need sanctuary in your church," how they're going to react to that? I mean, have you ever experienced that in a positive or negative way?
My dear friend Peter from Ammanford, who over a year ago, he's a real devout Catholic, and he said we should organise sanctuaries in churches. And of course, I can only kind of think about London, and I was vaguely thinking which church would be appropriate. I mean, ages ago, I had very, very close connections with St. James's Church, Piccadilly, but at this point, I wouldn't quite know. I looked into St. Martin's in Trafalgar Square under that perspective as well, and I did actually even send an email also, but I didn't get a response.
Well, here's a thought. The Bank for International Settlements in Basel, in Switzerland, which is the central banker's central bank. That's where, you know, Mark Carney comes from, you know, as from the Bank of Canada and the Bank of England now as well. He's taken over. And central banks like the Bank of Japan, where they all meet, is extrajudicial. I was hearing the other day from Adam Labore. He's a writer who's just written a book called, the investigative journalist he is, called The Tower of Basel. And he explains that if you get into this bank in Switzerland, in Basel, I mean, it's a long way to go, obviously, for most people, but if you get in there, then the police can't touch you. It's not even part of, even the Swiss police aren't allowed in.
Oh, it's another little Vatican, is it?
It is, yes. Okay. So at least there are all these little... there are a few safe havens around for people if, you know, you want to get away from the clutches of the law when the law goes wrong and justice is not being served.
Oh, come on, Tony. I mean, the whole purpose for the Basel of... Basel Bank being extrajudiciary is so that they can do whatever they do, which is completely criminal. I mean, the creation of money out of nothing and then to charge interest for it, preferably to governments, who then are also expected to charge taxes. Excuse me? I mean, that's the biggest criminal heist there is.
I think you've just rumbled me. I was having a bit of a joke there. But, I mean, there are some places, aren't there, that you can sort of get away from the law when the law goes wrong. Anyway, Sabine McNeil from www.victims-unite.net. Thank you very much for joining us again on Dialect.
Thank you for having me, Tony.
BCFM is the community radio station for Bristol and is here to give everybody in Bristol a voice.
Now, how many people living together does it take to make a fully self-sustaining modern community where there's enough specialists to deliver modern civilised needs and comforts such as health, education, water and power, transport and agriculture? And could such a community be entirely self-sustaining, not making everything itself, but having surpluses they could use to trade and barter with the outside world for what they couldn't make themselves? Well, these are the questions that gripped two people with Bristol connections, both of whom found themselves over at the Centre for Alternative Technology at McCunclith in Wales back in the early 1990s. One was the director of the Schumacher Society, Richard St. George, who sadly died last year. So as a tribute to Richard and his work, here is his colleague, former director of Solon South West Housing Association and also director of the Centre for Alternative Technology itself, Roger Kelly. He describes their plan, which ended up being called Ecoville 2000, because it looked like they would only be able to build this state-of-the-art eco-village community over in France. So here's Roger talking about Richard and his Ecoville 2000 at the Somerset Big Green Gathering back in the summer of 2007. And he's here talking about the founder of the Centre for Alternative Technology, former Army officer Gerard Morgan Grenville.
And he was always basically just thinking up crazy ideas, getting them set up, and then as soon as they were set up and seemed to be running by themselves, he left and thought up something else and got on with that. And he's been doing that for the whole of his life, and he's in his, he must be about 80 now, and he's still doing it, he's still coming up with new ideas. But anyway, when I first went to work at CAT, he was still the chair of the trustees. So although he'd left the place to run it itself by itself, because it was a registered charity, it had to have this board of trustees. And he and a group of his buddies, who were all these sort of upper-class toffs, had set themselves up as the trustees of CAT. And when I arrived there in 1988, which is 15 years after it was set up, they were still there as the trustees. But they never came to visit the place at all. They summoned the director of CAT to a club in London to explain what was going on, and in particular to go through the accounts in great detail, just in case the trustees were going to be liable for some horrible financial misfortune. So, as you can imagine, my first impression of him was not very favourable at all. And basically what I did was to look at this situation and decide that it was completely unsustainable in every sense of the word. And I wrote to him and the rest of the trustees and said I thought it was in the best interests of the place and its future if they stepped down from their roles and allowed us to form another body of trustees. And I really didn't expect them to do it, but they did, very graciously. I was extremely grateful for them doing that. So basically, Gerard Morgan Grenville sort of disappeared off my radar for several years. And then, I think it was about 1994, he appeared at CAT and said he wanted to talk to me about a new idea that he'd got. I went to meet him and had a chat to him. And his great new idea was, to put it in a nutshell, to mainstream the idea of eco-villages. In other words, he felt that there were some fantastic things about the whole concept of eco-villages, but that it was, to some extent in his view, hamstrung by the fact that the majority of people involved in eco-villages had no money, no resources, they had to start very small, they tended to grow very slowly, and there were all sorts of bits and pieces missing from the sort of grand picture as a result. And he felt that this had to be sort of taken up a few rungs and approached in many ways from the same perspective that any other kind of physical development, any new village, new town, new housing development, was approached. In other words, in a 100% professional way, but without compromising any of the ideas of the concept of an eco-village. And I sort of listened to him. And I mean, obviously by then I'd been at CAT for 5 or 6 years, and I was really engrossed in what we were doing there and not particularly interested in anything else. And I listened to him, and after he'd gone away, I thought about it and thought, oh, not really interested in this at all. It's, you know, what we're doing here is far more important. But being the sort of person he was, he didn't give up. So he kept phoning me up and writing to me and saying had I thought about it, and he'd got more ideas about it, he was developing them, but he wanted people like me, he said, to work with him to develop it further. And I think perhaps the turning point for me was that he said, well, the conclusion I've come to is that this isn't going to happen in the UK. It's just impossible. There's this combination of ridiculous land values, ridiculous planning laws, terrible bureaucracy, everything's militates against the idea of developing something like this in the UK. So we've got to look at somewhere else in Europe and at least set up a prototype there. And if it works somewhere else in Europe, we can eventually bring it back here when the environment is more favourable. fine, fine. So he said, well, what I'd like you to do is to come with me for a few weeks, I think it was, for Spain. I've made some contact with various government officials there, and they've identified some sites that might be suitable for a big eco-village development. So why don't you come and have a look at them? And basically, I couldn't turn down the offer of a free 3 weeks touring around Spain, looking at abandoned villages and sites. So I went with him. And we did look at some amazing places. They were mostly in the north of Spain, in Navarra, mostly in the foothills of the Pyrenees. And a lot of them were complete villages that had been abandoned because the government forestry department had decided they wanted to reforest the area. So they just basically told the villagers they had to move out. Sorry, we've got to go. So they moved them all out, and then in several cases they decided they weren't going to reforest them after all. So they'd gone through all this trouble of moving everybody out, but the villagers were still sitting there. And I mean, some of them were just amazing. But the government departments we were dealing with over there weren't moving themselves quickly enough for Gerard, so he began to lose patience with them. And because he was living in France at that time, he decided to try the French government instead. But this is the sort of person he is, you know, he doesn't sort of go and, well, he does go and talk to, you know, people who are setting up communities on the ground and so on, but he also just goes and marches into, you know, the President of France's office and says, you've got to do eco-village developments. And he did that, and they were very interested in the idea. And they pointed out to me one of the huge differences between here and a country like France, which, you know, has the same population but in more than double the land area. One of the big problems they had there was rural depopulation. Huge areas of countryside where people were just moving out en masse and leaving villages with just a handful of very elderly people. The French government were very concerned about this. They wanted to find a way of reversing that trend. But being the French government, they wanted to approach it from a very highly analytical, statistical, and very economics-based point of view. They looked at what Gerard was proposing and said, this is fine. We'll find some sites for you. We'll pay for a feasibility study. But what you've got to do is to come back with a study that proves that something like this is going to work, not just from a community point of view, but from an economic point of view. And you've actually got to provide us with detailed spreadsheets showing us for at least the first 3 years of the existence of this development exactly how much money is going to come in, how much money is going to go out, how it's going to be spent, what the cash flow is, where you're going to get the money from, so on and so forth. There we go. Okay, fine. Why not? Let's give it a try.
Former director of the Centre for Alternative Technology in Wales there, Roger Kelly, talking about plans put together back in the early 1990s with Richard St George for a giant self-sustaining eco-village. A state-of-the-art project. And this broadcast is a tribute to Richard, the director of Bristol's Create Centre-based Shoemaker Society, who sadly died last year. And there'll be more from Roger about Ecoville 2000 in coming weeks.
BCFM is the community radio station for Bristol and is here to give everybody in Bristol a voice.
Another voice. This is Tony Gosling. Another voice is Jason Yannakopoulos, back from a few weeks of holiday. Have you actually had a holiday, Jason, yet?
I did. I went to Scotland with my family.
Was it warm?
No.
Oh, no. That's a shame.
It was nice. I saw my cousin get married. So.
Oh, lovely.
William Broadhead to his beautiful wife Rachel.
Oh, beautiful! Well, that is there's some good news. How did you spend a while up in Scotland?
We spent a few days.
Yeah, how do you find the Scots themselves?
Fine. Although the ones I spoke to were surprisingly opposed to independence, which surprised me.
Oh, crikey! No, I am surprised about that. Yeah, I noticed the Welsh. I mean, I'm guessing as to why the Scots might not be that into independence, because we've had in the news this week the fact that the Welsh Parliament has passed a law to become law through the Welsh Parliament, guaranteeing decent wages for agricultural workers. And guess what's happened? This is only on just on the other side of the Bristol Channel, of course. Dominic Grieve has decided that it is unlawful for the Welsh Parliament to pass laws on such matters, and that because it's something to do with employment, this will not, in fact, get the royal assent.
Surprise.
So there's democracy for you. Looking after agricultural workers is not a priority for Dominic Grieve. Anyway, what do you got for us? You're clutching your copy of Private Eye again this week, Jason. What
it's
you got?
Interesting. They have raised an issue with some hypocrisy in a newspaper that I otherwise consider good. It's The Guardian. They were talking about they're having a special report. They had a special report on the murky world of life under 0 hours contract, where for those who don't know, 0 hour contract is effectively it's almost like working on commission. So they can't guarantee that you'll get work, and they can't guarantee you'll get paid, but you have some form of a contract that is there.
Right, so that doesn't sound very good. I was hearing that almost every single employee of McDonald's is on a 0 hours contract, so they don't actually guarantee you any work at all. All they're saying is you have to be there on the end of the phone, biting your nails, waiting for their phone call. So is that it in a nutshell? Is that what a 0 hours contract
yep,
is?
Yep, that is effectively it. I mean, the problem with Guardian is that they did this whole special report attacking 0 hours contracts, although it has been revealed by the Private Eye that, in fact, they themselves do 0 hour contracts.
Oh, and Amazon do as well, I understand.
Amazon quite notoriously do.
So, I mean, what's happened? I mean, this is terrible, isn't it? I mean, in Greece, things are pretty awful, but they're going that way here. The idea that all of the power is in the hands of the employer and none in the power of employees.
Well, absolutely. I mean, a friend of mine in Windsor has just found himself in a job that employs a 0 hour contract. In fact, he left that job after only 2 weeks when he'd only done a certain amount of sales, and the firm he is at, which I can't name the firm for you purely because I don't actually know, they refused to pay him.
No money at all?
No.
So he'd actually been working for them, but he actually didn't get paid any money because he hadn't been selling enough.
They said didn't do enough sales. I mean, I can't reveal any more because I don't actually know what the name of the company is.
Now, this is a sort of sharkish behaviour by employers. So are you saying that The Guardian are doing this kind of hiring people on these zero-hour contracts?
Yeah, well,
themselves?
At the same time, it says here that the whole of their iPad desk, that is the reporter for the sort of iPad version of The Guardian, the whole of that desk is entirely on 0 hour contracted staff.
Now that is naughty of The Guardian, and they're supposed to be championing the left. I do wonder about The Guardian sometimes, because I know they're massively in debt, aren't they? And so any kind of newspaper empire that is having to go to the banks every few months and beg them on their knees in order to survive, that's bound to affect their editorial and their business practices.
Indeed. The Guardian does actually claim that it has nobody employed in 0 hour contracts, but only on the grounds that the people employed on these very similar looking contracts do get some holiday pro rata.
Oh, right, okay. Well, no, I mean, that's better than nothing, isn't it? Because a lot of these zero-hour contracts,
they have zero guaranteed hours and no sick pay.
Well, that's not very good, but at least it means that they do have actually a bit of holiday.
They also have to take 1 month unpaid break and then enrol again to ensure they've got no legal employment rights.
Oh, that's appalling. And this is The Guardian. Are there any decent employers left in this country, Jason?
It's hard to say.
Okay. What else have you got there in Private Eye? Because I know I saw you earlier talking about George Osborne, was it?
Yes, this is very interesting. David Cameron declared that quite successfully he's taken credit for the
Lochearn. That Lochearn, was to do with the G8 conference, was it?
That is indeed. That countries should change their rules, that let companies shift their profit across borders, basically cut down on tax dodging to
like,
you and me.
Again, Amazon, again, as we heard before, and Google. And we were allowed to all Starbucks. Bingo.
So, those tax haven come. So without laws like that, tax haven companies remain tax-free and every country suffers. Now Cameron, who welcomed the OECD report, but the Private Eye points out that George Osborne has shredded UK's controlled foreign companies laws. In places like Germany and Luxembourg, they get taxed at 5%, and other profits diverted from real economies into British multinationals' tax havens. And those percentages will not be taxed at all.
So I don't understand that. Explain that in layman's terms.
That means that the Lord Mayor Creature Shed, some of it in places like Jersey and Luxembourg's, will get taxed at 5%, whereas the rest of the profits that are diverted from there into other tax havens will not be taxed at all. Oh. So effectively, the UK has legislated for the practice that the OECD and indeed David Cameron himself has condemned.
Oh, that's funny, isn't it? Because David Cameron's father was one of the pioneers of tax havens back in the night. As soon as they introduced exchange controls, which is one of the first things that the Thatcher government did in 1979-1980, this is before that, you weren't actually allowed to move money around from one country to another without permission, unless it was something which was beneficial to the UK in one way or another. Mm. Because they saw it was very obvious that if people could move money out of the country, then they would move it to a tax haven. And David Cameron's father made his money, made his loot, made his fortune on doing tax havens. So it's hardly likely that Cameron is going to be the pioneer of stopping tax havens, Jason.
Well, indeed. I mean, I think we're being entirely unrealistic to expect anything of the sort from the Eastmania-controlled coalition cabinet.
Well, so I've not heard it put like that before. Okay. Now, there is some resistance going on. Got a leaflet here from something called the WOW Petition. This is wowpetition.com. It says, resist the war on welfare. I guess that's what WOW is, the war on welfare. Sick and disabled people and carers have been unfairly targeted with cuts, it says here. They call, that is the War on Welfare petition, call for a cumulative impact assessment of welfare reform and a new deal for sick and disabled people based on their needs, abilities and ambitions. They're calling for a cumulative impact assessment of all cuts and changes affecting sick and disabled people, their families and carers, a free vote on repeal of the Welfare Reform Act, an immediate end to the work capability assessment as voted for by the British Medical Association. Good yes. idea. This work capability assessment, what is it?
Work capability assessment, this is the assessment that's done by our good friends Atos.
Oh dear, our good friends. Oh well, they're not that.
That was for those at home in inverted commas.
They're also calling here for a consultation between the Departments of Health and Education to improve support into work for sick and disabled people. Independent committee based inquiry into welfare reform. So you can sign if you want to online at wowpetition.com. It's not just a petition. Now, parcel of all of this, of course, is the fact that there aren't really many people believe more than enough jobs out there for those who are unemployed. I mean, I can say that as someone who applies for jobs myself. I've got a part-time job, and it's almost like the fact that I've got a part-time job means that a lot of full-time employers are not even vaguely interested in me applying for them, so I'm applying for other part-time jobs. What about you, Jason? Are you finding how are you finding the jobs market?
I'm still fully unemployed. I've taken a look at getting some voluntary work just to get some funding in until I find a full-time paid job, but the job market out there is terrible. And
well, I'll tell you why.
The really bad thing, I think, while we were on the subject of the WOW petition, is that a lot of the private sector companies won't employ someone even if they show a hint of having a mental health disability.
Well, yes, and then they're expecting people like that to get the jobs. Well, there is another problem, and that is called quantitative easing. And what that's doing
What's quantitative easing, Tony?
QE is printing money. That's what the Bank of England, our new wonderful Dracula, Mark Carney, King Carnage, taking over the Bank of England. He's really all for this wonderful quantitative easing, because, of course, what it does is it pumps up a bubble in the what's called an asset bubble. So that means that all the value of assets, things like buildings, land, commodities, this kind of thing, and the stock exchange goes up and up and up. And all the money is sucked out of the real economy and into that casino economy of the stock exchange. So slowly but surely, the real economy is going to become, and it is as it happens now, slowly but surely more and more dead on its feet. And the money is sucked up into this asset bubble. And we all know what happens with bubbles.
Eventually, they
go bang, and that's what's going to happen. And as a result of all that, there's an article in The Eye this week. Benefit cuts won't get unemployed into work, councils warn. The benefit cuts are supposed to get people back to work, but they're driving down the living standard of hundreds of thousands who have no position, who are in no position to find a job. A devastating assessment of Ian Duncan Smith's reforms says on Monday. Researchers who've used data to forecast what will happen if the 1.18 million households where no one works have calculated that 155,000, that's one in eight people, can mitigate the effect by finding work near their home. Another 115,000 have the opportunity to move to more affordable housing. The rest, more than three quarters, will see their incomes drop, according to a study for the Local Government Association by the Centre for Economic and Social Inclusion. The effects will be felt all over the country, with fears they could force councils to cut spending on roads, refuge collection and care for the elderly in order to help those made vulnerable by the cuts. So they're not going to actually, these cuts are not going to in any way help people get into work.
And local authorities. Think anyone with them. I think the reasonable person could have probably seen that from probably a while ago. I mean, these are not really targeted to help people get into it. They're more just targeting disabled people. And we've said this time and time again. I mean, the fact that it's not working, we've seen the system isn't working. This has been covered after many weeks, through many months.
So what's your assessment of what's really behind this, Jason?
It's hard to say. They just want to stop having to spend money on disabled people. This is effectively a war on disabled people, if anything. It is a war on welfare.
But it's not all, it's not just disabled people. It's also people in low-paid work as well, or lower-paid work, because another survey
it's still welfare.
Well, another, yeah, because a lot of those people are on benefits. You're quite right. More than half of workers want to change jobs. Workers are increasingly fed up, says the I, back at the end of last week, with their careers, with one in three thinking of changing jobs and over half actually now wanting to look elsewhere for jobs. Now, that's, you know, more than half of workers actually want to change their job. Now, that tells us something, doesn't it, about the work market, that people are actually being forced.
It tells us about the level of dissatisfaction in the workplace as well.
And also, this is maybe partly this imbalance of power between the employer and the employee, where people are having to...
That is only going to extend under the current works of the condemned government, if you will.
Another piece of news, also in the same copy of the Eye from the end of last week, Conservative membership has halved since David Cameron became party leader and is thought to be close to just 100,000, a fraction of its heyday of 3 million under the Tories' fear. 3 million down to 100,000. He's not doing very well, David Cameron.
No, indeed. The only thing that keeps the Tory party going is Tory papers, you know?
Well,
It's the thing. I mean, out of the 20-odd people I know that voted Conservative at the last general election, only three of them are still behind the Conservative Party.
Well, talking of Tory papers, we have a copy of the Daily Mail here.
Oh, dear God. Well, burn it! Kill it with fire!
I know you're not a great fan of it, but there's a great front page here, and that is this is Monday's Daily Mail. Revealed the Prince's extraordinary lobbying campaign since the election. Prince Charles is a neighbour of ours, Jason. Have you been to see him up in Tetbury?
Well, actually, I live in Windsor.
Oh, he's not far from Bristol. I mean, are you on the way to Windsor? If you're going in your limousine, I mean, you could maybe make a slight diversion up to Tetbury.
Oh, thanks for stressing out the limousine. Thanks, Tony. That's mean.
Yes, Prince Charles has 36 private summits with cabinet ministers, the Daily Mail is revealing, which does make...
Queen has one a week, surely.
Well, that's right. She certainly does. But every few weeks, I'm not sure about the calculation. This looks like Charles is talking to a cabinet minister, having a private meeting, secret meeting, I would even say, with the cabinet minister once a month. Now, it seems that
the same
both...
one? Is it the Secretary of State for Agriculture?
Yeah, I bet it is, actually. Let's have a look.
Defra.
It probably is. But, I mean, what about the constitutional position of Prince Charles? Because that is... There's all sorts of questions here about... You know, these meetings are all secret. They're not covered by freedom of information. What is Prince Charles saying to these ministers? Is he telling them that they're not allowed to bring in particular laws? Because we know he's got a veto on laws, anything that affects him.
Are they allowed to enact?
And of course, he's a businessman, basically. You know, he's not just Prince Charles. He's got the Prince Charles Empire, which doesn't have to pay tax. That is the Duchy of Cornwall.
Sounds like most of the empires I know of.
So what has Charles been saying? I mean, I wonder, did the Civil War ever happen?
It's intriguing, isn't it? Because They invited that, you know, after they got rid of the king and they brought in a parliament. They brought in parliament, they brought in Cromwell, and, well, let's say the Cromwell wasn't exactly a nice person, but still.
Well, I mean, they were supposed to get rid of the monarchy, but then let's go through the history a little bit. It's back in, do you remember the 1640s?
I can't say I was alive then.
Well, anyway, that was the Civil War.
I was born in the 1980s.
King Charles I, he started doing something in the 1630s called fining landowners for enclosing land. That is basically, he was anti-privatisation because the big landowners across Britain had been privatising land or enclosing land.
But is that not a good thing, being anti-privatisation?
Well, it is, yes. That's quite interesting, isn't it? Anyway, the merchants.
The king being anti-privatisation.
Yes, the king was. Because what happened was Archbishop Laud, who was originally, I think, from Cheltenham, he went and became Archbishop, he was going to Charles I saying, there's lots of poor people living in ditches right across Britain, and I think we should do something about this, Charles. And Charles, of course, he would reply,
Yes, absolutely, completely agree.
Can we levy taxes at the same time? And, of course, Archbishop Laud said, I think we can, sir. And so that's what they did, is they started taxing the landowners who had been kicking people off their land back in the 1630s, enclosing them. And he started levying fines, Charles I did, on the merchant class people who were doing this privatisation of the land. And therefore the merchants didn't like that, so they decided to have a civil war. And eventually chopped the king's head off in 1649. Now, the feudal chiefs were out, and it was the merchant classes taking over. Now, that had happened in many cities across the world. Places like Venice were a city-state run by the merchant class, but it had never happened ever before in an entire country. So Britain was the first capitalist country.
But here's the thing I want to interject here. Sort of thing. Before they cut King Charles' head off, they actually allowed him to meet his family one last time, and it happened in a pub in my hometown of Maidenhead.
Oh, really?
Which is now, unfortunately, in NatWest, although the pub exists in name.
And anyone that's interested in the Civil War, the BBC have made some really rubbishy programmes about the Civil War. I don't know what it was. There was one recently I watched about 5 minutes and I thought, this is rubbish. But there is a very good... Well, there's a terrific DVD called By the Sword Divided, which is about I think it was filmed in the 1970s or 1980s. And it's about a family, half of whom are on the side of the Roundheads and the other half are on the side of the Cavaliers. And, of course, it causes all sorts of ructions in the family. And it's terrific. And it also is brilliant, bit of old style, old school period drama. So, anyway, back to the story. Charles has 36 private summits with the cabinet ministers. There has been no civil war. Maybe we need another one, Jason. What do you think?
Oh, wow. I think there definitely needs to be an inquiry as to sort of power that Charles has. I mean, he's not the king. He's not the head of state. He is.
How come he gets
theoretically at this point? Then he is just a businessman. He's just a citizen like you and me. And certainly, I haven't had any summits with any cabinet minister, even if one of them is my local MP.
Well, maybe you've got the wrong-headed notepaper, and maybe you've got the wrong outfit. Maybe I tell you, let's try this, Jason. Why don't we do this? We'll do is we'll get you some sort of the Duke of Maidenhead. Demands presence
of the Home Secretary.
We'll get you a terrific outfit, right? One of those like robes they use in the House of Lords, and maybe you can speak in a very very important sounding voice. Do you want to try it out now?
I would say that I do request a meeting with the Home Secretary.
Very good. I think you've got it. And also, part of the agenda will probably be something to do with sacking Atos and fining them.
Yes, excellent. Great idea.
And actually seizing their assets and using them to redistribute around all disabled people right across Britain. I think you might become a local hero. Okay, Jason Yannakopoulos, thanks ever so much. Bristol Community FM 93.2. Well, no Jeff this week, but his What's Gone guide is here. No, not the What's Gone guide, the What's On guide. Starting with Friday the 16th of August, Ashes to Angels will be performing with support from The Dead Lay Waiting, Her Dark Embrace and Heaven Asunder at the Fleece in St Thomas's Street in Bristol. Tickets are £5 in advance and doors open at 7:30 p.m. Manifesto there on Fire Records, a 12-inch single called Walking Backwards. And I know John Peel played that back in the early 1990s. Into Saturday the 17th of August, and King Kurt plus special guests will be performing at the Fleece in St Thomas's Street, Bristol. Tickets are £15 in advance and doors open at 7:30pm. Finally, on the 17th of August, the ZZ Top tribute act, the ZZ Tops, will be performing at the Tunnels in Bristol and Exeter Mews. Tickets are £10 in advance and doors open at 7:30pm. That's all from me. Thanks for listening and have a good week. And have a good week too, Jeff. Take care and goodbye. That's all for this week. Dialects, a weekly podcast for your MP3 player, produced by volunteers and broadcast on Bristol Community FM 93.2 at 2 p.m. every Friday afternoon. If you're online, you can subscribe to our RSS feed or email list, which reminds you every Tuesday evening when Dialect goes online. You can do that or download this weekly podcast from dialectradio.co.uk. Thanks to our guests, Roger Kelly, ex-director of the Centre for Alternative Technology, and also Sabine McNeil from victimsunite.net, and also to studio engineer Dave Bazanko. Dialect's a Bristol Broadband Co-op production, and everyone and anyone can contribute. If you'd like to, do please contact us through Volunteering Bristol 0117 989 7733, and you'll find them on the web at bristolvolunteers.org.uk. That was Dialect, and I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a very good week. Thanks for listening. So until the same time next week, goodbye for now. We'll be right back.
And there's a note on the sleeve of this record that says materialism is slowly but surely destroying everything that makes life worth living. There are people fighting to change things before it's too late. Join them, and gives the phone numbers for Greenpeace and Friends of the Earth. This is Children of Dub.